Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a name. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. It is 11.05 a.m., and my name is Virginia.
My name is Noah.
And we're your hosts for today's show. On today's show, we'll be hearing an interview with Melissa Munn, who is a professor at Okanagan College and has been an activist focusing on issues facing prisoners for over two decades. We talked to Melissa about the Penal Press Project, a digitization project of newspapers produced inside prisons in Canada. We will then be airing an interview from the It's Going Down podcast with Victoria from the group Live Free Merced on the conditions in Merced County jails, where approximately 100 prisoners have been on hunger strike since the evening of September 8th. But first, as we often do, we'll start the show with some news.
Supporters of Homa Hoodfar held a demonstration at Concordia University on Wednesday of this week. The retired Concordia professor has been imprisoned in Iran since June 6th on what her family says are trumped-up charges of collaboration with a hostile government and propaganda against the state. Recent news reports have stated that Hoodfar has been transported to a hospital recently because of deteriorating health problems exacerbated by months in solitary confinement.
According to itsgoingdown.org, prisoners at Deer Ridge Correctional Institution in Madras, Oregon, were placed on preemptive lockdown to repress potential striking activity. Prisoners at this prison are reporting that the administration's food service coordinators are systematically employing methods which put the health and safety of prisoners at risk. Folks inside reported that the prison is serving undercooked food, using unsanitary food substitutes to save money, and using food products marked unfit for human consumption that are expired, rotten, and moldy. Prisoners are asking outside supporters to call the prison to demand that they meet the Oregon state law standards for healthy and safe prison food and serve prisoners adequate food portions and stop serving moldy, rotten, and expired food. Folks can call Superintendent Tim Causey at 541-325-5999, extension 5226. People can also call Health Services Manager Becky Carter at 541-325-5999, extension 5145. The Prison Radio Show will post this information on our blog in case you didn't catch those phone numbers. So after our show, you can go to prisonradioshow.wordpress.com.
Lots happened on September 9th, and many prisons in the U.S. continue to see resistance inside, including work strikes, hunger strikes, and uprisings. At least 29 prisons were affected by the strike, either through preemptive lockdowns or through strike actions that led to a lockdown. More than 24,000 prisoners missed work because of lockdowns. The Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee has been tracking the strike and calling into different prisons to get more information. To see their most updated information, check out itsgoingdown.org's page on the prison strike for a link to a Google Doc with state-by-state information. Some prisoners in Canada published a letter of support to striking prisoners in the U.S. If we have time, we'll read some excerpts from that later on today.
Next up, we'll be hearing an interview with Melissa Munn, who has been organizing to support prisoners for over two decades. Melissa also teaches at Okanagan College. In this interview, she talked to the Prison Radio Show specifically about the Penal Press Project, which is a digitization project of newspapers produced inside prisons in Canada since the 1950s.
I'm a professor of sociology and gender studies at Okanagan College, but that's what I get paid to do. My other work is as an activist, and so I've been doing that work for about 25 years or so, and I work on human rights issues, but primarily my focus is on prisoners and prisoner rights and on post-release issues that prisoners face and working with long-termers inside to help them use their time as well as they can.
We got in touch with you for the Prison Radio Show to talk specifically about the Penal Press Project, although if you end up having other projects that you would like us to talk about, let me know. I guess my first question is, can you talk about the Penal Press Project? What is it, just for folks who've never heard of it before?
Sure. So the Penal Press is a long institution around the world. In Canada, the Penal Press started in the really late 1940s. And what it is prisoner-written, produced newsletters or magazines. They range from weeklies to monthlies, and or bi-monthlies, and they really give the prisoner's perspective on incarceration. And they're not necessarily academic. Sometimes there's works of fiction, there's humorous articles, sometimes they're addressing really serious topics, sometimes they're doing that in a very academic way, but it's not essential. So the Penal Press has a diversity to it that really helps people to see prisoners as people and with a variety of interests, with a variety of backgrounds, with different hopes and aspirations. When the Penal Press started, really in earnest in 1950 with the publication of the Kingston Penitentiary Telescope, the idea was that this was going to be a way for prisoners to communicate with the administration in a constructive way. So prisoners could critique the system as long as it was done in a kind of respectful way and didn't call out individuals, but really push for and advocate for changes. So that's the history of the Penal Press, where it comes from. What I've been doing over the past, 8 years or so now, is working to collect Penal Press materials from Canada in particular and to make these available to anybody who wants them. And that work comes directly from a former professor of mine, Robert Gaucher, who spent decades collecting Penal Press materials, traveling across the country, going to libraries and archives and subscribing and working with other activists like Claire Culhane. And for decades, he built this collection, a print collection. And when he retired from the University of Ottawa, he bequeathed these materials to me in the hopes that I would do something with them. So he had spent all this time collecting them, and then he wanted them to be used. And so what I've done is created an online open access archive so that anybody who wants to read these materials from all these decades since they've been in print can go on and do that.
You started answering my next question a little bit already, which is about how and why the Penal Press project got started. Maybe you could focus specifically on like how you got started creating this open access archive.
Well, as I said, I inherited this collection from Bob Gaucher, Professor Gaucher at the University of Ottawa, and the material contained in the Penal Press is really history from within. It's really grounded, lived experience, and it paints a completely different picture in many respects to what the official discourse says. So, you know, this will come as no surprise to your listeners, particularly those who are incarcerated, but what you hear from the state and what prisoners experience often don't even seem like they're talking about the same thing. And so what was really important to me was to give more access to these voices, and particularly the historical voices. During the early 50s, early 60s is the period that I'm really working on right now, and looking at the reforms the government said they were putting in and how prisoners experience those. And so getting the voice of prisoners out there in the same way that publications like the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons does is really important if you want to understand the carceral state that we're in.
Have you found that there are other people who've started using the archives in the Penal Press project for other publication-type projects, for other research projects on the outside?
Yes, it's been really interesting over the years how many other academics and other people have contacted me about the materials. It's that they want to use them for research they're doing. So I've had several master's and PhD students write to me and ask if I have other materials that they could access. Because, of course, you know, the Penal Press is something that I do off the side of my desk. I mean, I'm using it to write a book at the moment, and that's fantastic. But in terms of getting all the materials up on the website, it's a slow process, and I like to involve students in it, so it goes kind of deliberately slow in some ways. So quite often I'll get somebody calling me saying, I'm really interested in this period and this publication, and do you have any more on it? And quite often I do, because there's only just under 1,200 publications on the site, and I have a collection of about 2,500. And so about half of them are on the site so far, and you know, I try and get a couple up every month, a couple new ones every month, just to keep forward momentum. But I do like to involve my students, my own students, in working with the Penal Press materials so that they can learn from that and so that they can experience doing kind of archival work at a real level. I've also had former writers from the Penal Press contact me and say, hey, I wrote for Ghost Courier, I wrote for Panorama in this period, and do you have it? And in fact, I was contacted by one of the very first editors of a publication in Quebec called Panorama, and he was looking for some of the ones that he had worked on. And that was really phenomenal to have this man in his 90s still interested in the work he had done when he was in his 20s. So that was fantastic. So I'm seeing that. I know that in Kingston at Queen's University, there's a professor there who actually uses the Penal Press to teach about silk screening and that process. So we're seeing a diverse interest in the Penal Press and how it gets used. And I think that's fantastic because, as I said, the Penal Press really does humanize the men and women in prison. And it shows the diversity of color in terms of their interests and in terms of their perspective on the world. And so anytime, you know, we can get activists or individuals to use the site is a great thing.
So it sounds like people contact you in a bunch of different ways. I noticed that in the recent issue of the Gabber that's been uploaded onto the Penal Press website, there's info about you and the Penal Press project. And I was curious how that came about. Are you in touch with folks inside about the Penal Press project? How have you gotten in touch with folks who are involved in current press projects inside? And how do you stay in touch with people once that happens?
Well, you know, it's always a challenge when you're needing to go into prisons to make contact or relying on old-fashioned mail to make contact. But over the years, as I said, I've been an activist in prisons for more than a few decades now. And so I've met lots of not only prisoners, but workers in the system who are progressive and who see the merit in the kind of work I do. And so I'm often in the prisons to do work with long-termers about how to use time well, how to prepare for parole board hearings, what to expect when they get released from prison. And so I've been going across the country for years doing that because that's really my major area of expertise. And so I go in and I meet with prisoners there, and inevitably, you know, we'll talk during breaks about what else do you do, and I talk about the Penal Press. And that really is something of interest to prisoners. I've also been in a couple of institutions over the past year with my colleague, a historian, Dr. Chris Clarkson, also at Okanagan College, to talk to prisoners about the history of the Penal Press. And that's been supported, again, by some really progressive wardens and social program officers who see the merit of the Penal Press historically, in terms of them gaining knowledge of how it came about and just general knowledge, but also for current use. The Penal Press was never meant to be a beef sheet against the administration. It was always meant to be something constructive, and it was initiated for the most part by administrators, by the commissioner at the time and his assistant commissioner, Joe McCauley. And they really wanted it because they wanted a direct line of communication with prisoners. They wanted the public to see prisoners as people and not just as convicts. And so I think when we get really progressive staff in institutions, they see the merit of prisoners learning about this and learning what constructive criticism was and how you can advocate for change when things aren't going well or where there is a glitch in the system. So sometimes I've been able to go in and do that, and really I've been, Chris and I, because we're focusing on the early period in our book, so that's what we've been talking to prisoners about when we go in to do the workshop. How did the press get set up, and what did it look like, and what was its purpose, and was it effective? And the answer is yes, the Penal Press was very effective in bringing about change. And change in big things, but also change in the small daily living conditions. How was canteen run? How did the inmate fund get allocated? When did you get tobacco rations? How did you get released? All of those things the Penal Press had influence on and really changed for the better in terms of the conditions that prisoners experienced. And so I think, you know, knowing that leads the way forward. Now, we don't have a lot of Penal Press in Canada and at the moment, and that's not surprising coming out of the Harper conservative era. I'm hoping that we'll see some less regressive trends in penal reform over the next decade, now that we have a new government in place and one that seems to be a bit more progressive, and perhaps prisoners will again take up the mantle and start more Penal Press publications and use them in a really constructive, forward-moving way.
I think you touched on some of my next question already as well, but if you want to expand on what motivates you to continue doing a project like this. I mean, you've talked about being an activist and having been involved in prisoner justice stuff for a really long time, and so if you just want to talk about that a little more, that would be great.
Well, the Penal Press Project is really a love of mine in terms of the kind of information it provides. And when I started working with Chris Clarkson on our book, and he's a historian, and he just looked at these documents and said, why haven't people been using these yet? Why isn't this a major focus in criminological research? And his point is well taken, that we have this really rich reserve of material that has just been ignored for the most part. There hasn't been much written on it. And largely that was because access to it was very difficult. I mean, Bob spent decades accumulating it and storing it and preserving it. And so, you know, I think we all owe him a great debt of gratitude for preserving the prisoner's voice and helping to set the historical record straight. So for me, the richness of the information is fantastic. It also shows how far we've come on certain things and how much we haven't moved in other areas. So when you read the early penal press from the 50s, some of the issues that they're talking about, we're still talking about. So, for example, in the 50s, prisoners are talking about the drug problem, and I put that in quotations, but you know, their solution is legalization and safe injection sites. And that was in the 50s. And we're still having conversations about that and still debating the merits of legalization and criminalization and those kinds of things. So I really think in many ways the prisoners were way ahead of their time. The people who were writing for the press really had a sophisticated and deep understanding. And for me, bringing that forward and using it to advocate for change to occur is really important. So if they're writing about this in the 50s, and we're almost 70 years later, it's time. It's time to do something different. It's time to pay attention to what the experts, the prisoners, are saying. And I think people would be very surprised if they read the press at how reasoned and careful the writers are about their suggestions. And careful not in terms of, oh, I better not say this, but careful in terms of giving it deep consideration and thinking through the complexity of issues and then suggesting a way forward. So for me, it's a, you know, this is a labor of love in terms of trying to get that information out so people can go, ah, now it's time for change. It's time to do something different. And maybe to inspire current prisoners to not feel so isolated, not feel like they can't have any say, because certainly my sense of the shift over the decades that I've been going in and out of prisons is that prisoners really do feel that they can't speak out, they can't make constructive change, or else their risk assessment will be negatively impacted, or their chance of release will be negatively impacted. And I'm not sure that I buy that necessarily. I think that there's a way forward, and certainly, you know, the penal press publications that are out there now have some great stuff in them. Out of Bounds magazine is still published out of Williams Head Institution, and it still talks about serious issues and like restorative justice and points to different ways of doing things. And I think that's useful and helpful, not only for prisoners and administrators, but for the public.
How can folks on the inside get involved and or submit newspapers to be archived with the project?
So the Gabber Express just started coming to me one day from a prisoner I'd met many, many years ago whose family had heard about my website and had told him about it. And all of a sudden one day these publications just arrived in the mail saying, here you go, can you please make sure that these are made available? So sometimes it's just prisoners' families telling them about the Penal Press website and them saying, I have some. So I get them just in the mail, and then I'll scan them, digitize them, and code them and upload them to the website. In other cases, they get sent to me in digital copy. People say, I'll scan this in and send it to you. Some people find, they have a family member who passes away, and they find these boxes with old penal press materials in them that their parents had either written or family member had written or had a subscription to, and they'll say, do you have these and do you want them? And And I'm more than happy to travel places and scan them for myself if people want to keep their originals, or you know, have them send them to me and I'll send them back. So people can get them to me in whatever way works easiest for them, because while I have an extensive collection, there are certainly gaps in it. You know, years where I'm missing issues that were put out that I just don't have copies of, or where people have nicer copies than mine. I was at Queen's University this year, and the librarian there, Kimberly Bell, has been super helpful in helping me round out my collection, and I too have some that they don't have, and so I've been sending them the ones that I have that they don't. And so just that kind of partnership of getting the information back and forth to each other has been really useful. And I think people are very responsive because they know that this is not something I make any money on. This is not something that I'm funded to do. This is just something that I do off the side of my desk now with the help of my colleague. And certainly my institution, Okanagan College, has been super supportive in terms of providing students in the summer to work on it and helping defray some of the costs of maintaining a website. But otherwise, I think people are just responsive because they get that this is important information, and so they'll send it to me in whatever way they can.
Do you have a mailing address that folks inside could get in touch with you through?
Absolutely. So they can contact me at Okanagan College, and the address is 7000 College Way, and that's in Vernon, British Columbia, and the postal code is V1B2N5. So Victor 1 Bravo 2 November 5. And I'm always happy to get letters about the penal press, get copies of the penal press, or answer any kind of questions people have about it. I'm also happy to hear from inmate committees or lifers groups or 10 plus groups about the other work I do in terms of getting out and staying out workshops. Happy to send in material. I have booklets available for prisoners on that cost nothing. I'm happy to send in the Getting Out, Staying Out booklet. And we've never had a problem getting that through. In fact, they seem to like it coming in. And it's all information that I collected from lifers on the street that they said would be helpful to men inside. And so I've collated that for them, and those are available for free too. So information on the penal press or information on getting out and staying out, I'm happy to answer any letters on that.
And then how can folks on the outside get involved in the project and or support the project?
Well, I think, you know, spreading the word about www.penalpress.com is super helpful, just to let more people know. And again, if people have copies of penal press materials, that's really helpful. And I think if people start using it, you know, certainly there are academics and researchers and activists and students in your listenership who might benefit from using these materials. And that's why I've put them up, so that more people than just me can use them. And so I think that's important as well. I advocate a lot when I travel around for people to actually use this material. So I think those are the major ways that people on the outside can know about it. They can encourage or help provide a subscription to some of the publications that are in existence, Out of Bounds Magazine, for example, the Gabber Express. That would be helpful to those publications for sure, to have more subscriptions, because they're costly to put together, and so that can be prohibitive. I know at Mission they were trying to get one going at Mission Medium, and you know, where the funds were going to come from was a problem. And so if you know people in the institutions who maybe are interested, then helping to fund that would be by donation or subscription would be very helpful.
Awesome. I think that's completely it for my questions. Is there anything that I missed or that you wanted to add that you didn't get to say already?
Well, I think the one thing that I would add is that the penal press has always been used by advocates and activists in Canada. So much of my collection comes from not only Bob collecting, but people like Claire Culhane, who I consider the greatest activist in Canada during her lifetime for prisoners, for sure. She collected them as subscriptions to know what was going on in prison, and I think that's critical, that this has always been a tool for activists. This has always been a way of communicating between not only the administration and prisoners, but outside supports. And so I think it's really critical that that piece doesn't get lost.
That was an interview with Melissa Munn speaking with the Prison Radio Show about her work with the Penal Press Project. You can find out more about the Penal Press Project at penalpress.com. The time is presently 11:32, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
Last year, Vanessa Gray, a young woman from the Amjanong First Nation, shut down Enbridge's Line 9 on Anishinaabe territory. For this act of civil disobedience, she was charged with mischief endangering life. She now faces 25 years to life in prison. This is clearly a tactic to discourage land defenders and resistance to the fossil fuel industry. On Tuesday, September 27th, come hear Vanessa Gray and her sister Lindsay Gray speak about their struggle and their upcoming court case. There will also be a panel discussion on direct action and civil disobedience and how to strengthen Vanessa's legal defense. Tuesday, September 27th, 7 p.m. at the Adams Building Auditorium on 3450 University Street. Defending Land Defenders, Solidarity with Vanessa Gray, a co-presentation of Divest McGill, Climate Justice Montreal, Economics for the Anthropocene, and CKUT.
The Center for Gender Advocacy invites you to our fall event series, Another Word for Gender. On Friday, September 30th, 6 p.m., come hear a keynote centering the margins, intersectionality as practice, with award-winning and internationally acclaimed educator, writer, and artist Kim Katrin Milan. That's in room H110 Hall Building. Also join us on Friday, September 23rd, 5 p.m. in MB1.210 JMSB Building, for a panel discussion on anti-black racism with organizers from Ottawa, Toronto, and Montreal, a collaboration with QPRIG's Disorientation. For a full listing of events, visit us at genderadvocacy.org. Events are wheelchair accessible with free childcare on request. For more details, call 514-937-2110. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Next up, we are going to be airing an interview that the It's Going Down podcast put together. In it, they speak with a woman named Victoria from the group Live Free Merced. Victoria has a spouse in a Merced County jail, which I believe is in California. And since the evening of September 8th, Victoria has been on hunger strike alongside the approximately 100 prisoners in Merced County jails. In this interview excerpt, which was made for the Prison Radio Show, Victoria discusses the conditions in Merced County jails in the lead-up to the hunger strike, including police drills and suicides. Hunger strikers are calling for the end of solitary confinement for youth, as well as the immediate dismissal of one of the sheriffs, Lieutenant Moore, who is seen as responsible for much of the brutality in the jails.
Okay, we're joined here today with Victoria from Live Free Merced. She's a community organizer, activist, and advocate. And Victoria, you're on hunger strike right now. Why are you on hunger strike?
I'm on hunger strike because I'm desperate for change. And I've been to board meetings. I've tried speaking with elected officials, our sheriff, our corrections department, and I feel like no one's hearing us from inside and behind the walls and out here in the community.
So just so everybody knows, how did the connection between the people that are currently incarcerated in the jails that are taking action right now in Merced, how did they come to be part of the mobilization on September 9th? How did that all come together?
I basically saw that there was going to be this large action, and we had discussed it previously, and they wanted... they had reached back out. You know, I sent the information to the facilities, and they came back out and said, we want to be a part of this. This affects us. It's affecting our families all across the nation. and we were, you know, they wanted to be a part of it to bring light, you know, what's going on in our prisons, the working conditions of the prisons, as well as, you know, our local issues.
Okay, and just to be clear, we're talking about two facilities right now that are involved in this, and they're both county jails, and they're both run by the Sheriff's Department, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so let's just kind of back up and talk about the big picture. What is, you said there were some issues in the jails in Merced. What are some of the main things that are causing people to take such action that is, you know, that is causing this response from the authorities, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but kind of paint a picture for us. What does the jails in Merced that these individuals are housed in, what does it look like? What are the main problems, and why are people so angry?
The main issue that they want immediate action to are not having S and Y sensitive yard inmates, you know, protective custody folks handling food, chemicals, and clothing, because they're obviously putting things in there that is dangerous and very unsanitary for the general population to consume. So that's a huge issue, and it's a particular security threat group as well. So that's one of the main things. And then we have a problem lieutenant, Lieutenant Moore from the Merced Sheriff's Corrections. He has been very abusive verbally. He has authorized raids where inmates are, detainees, because these are pretrial detainees, are being severely injured. You know, officers going in without badges, wearing ski masks, shooting people on site, even when they're down, people being shot with rubber bullets, bag rounds and pepper rounds, and, you know, having flash grenades thrown at them. And, you know, they're bringing dogs and, you know, stick them on people. It's just really scary. And this is a jail, you know, where people are not yet convicted. So that's another one. As well as, you know, classifications. You know, they pick and choose on, the most part, who they're going to classify as a quote-unquote gang member. And there are many people sitting inside these classification housing that aren't even affiliated, but are now having gang enhancements added to their cases. So they're looking at significant extra amounts of time. So that's something else that they want to be addressed. And they're angry because it's been going on for so long, and many people have been affected, you know, on and off over, you know, since their youth, you know what I mean? So
Right.
It's a lot.
Right. So you're saying, and again, these are county jails, so somebody gets picked up, let's say, you know, on a shoplifting charge or whatever, you know, they had an outstanding warrant, or like you said, maybe they just got, you know, they got picked up and they're not even, quote, guilty or whatever, and then they're stuck in the county jail for a couple days and all this stuff is happening. What are some of the incidents that the police are using such extreme measures? You know, you're talking about they're shooting them with different projectiles and stuff like that. What would drive them to engage in that type of violence with the people that are in the jail?
The last raid of that magnitude took place on June 30th of this year, and the inmates did not have time. They called it a random raid, and it was authorized by Lieutenant Moore. Again, he authorized another one of these types of raids. And, you know, we brought it to the light on July 12th, you know, about a couple weeks later, to the Board of Supervisors. We want to know why these type of raids are taking place, what the purpose is, because from our inside information was that they're using them as some type of free training. And that, to me, seems like significant, cruel, and unusual punishment, because not only are our loved ones being detained in these facilities, like, we don't even know if they're going to be safe, you know, depending on the outcome of the case. We don't know. They might not make it home alive. They might not see their trial date, and that's scary.
Wow. Has there been anybody that has passed away in the jail recently? I know in Modesto, a little bit above you, there's a horrible track record of people dying in the jail there. Is there a history of that happening as well in Merced?
Not recently. I mean, the most significant person that was injured was my spouse. His name is Richard Yanez Castillo Jr. He was shot in the head. His hand was shattered in 10 places. His leg was lacerated. He did survive, but all I knew was that he was down when the COs took him out, and I got third party information, and the jail wouldn't give us information. Over 14 hours, myself and my child, about 13-year-old son, we didn't know if he was dead, and that was the most excruciating pain. We do have a significant amount of suicide at the John Matarocca Jail. that's also in Merced County, and we're trying to figure out how these inmates are getting access, or they're being housed alone for some reason, and then they're being found hanging. And it's happening like every month almost. We're having another suicide, and it's really questionable as to why that's happening out there at that facility.
Wow. My heart really goes out to you for that. So you're saying your husband passed away due to an altercation with the guards at the facility?
Oh, no. We didn't know if he was dead.
Oh.
He's alive.
Okay.
He's alive. I'm sorry. He is alive, but we didn't know if he was dead. They would not give us any information. All I wanted was to know if you guys took him to the hospital, is he okay? Can you tell me if he's alive? They would not give me any information. It was awful, and my son and I had to suffer through that. My toddler doesn't understand, but my oldest does. So that was really, really hard. And, you know, his hand is completely damaged. So, and it was the first time he's ever had anything broken. But the way that they have shot him in the head, that was, like, so scary.
God, that's, yeah.
We have had people die in the facilities from these type of altercations. We had a 2006 case. Cedric Davis, he died during an altercation in this jail, in Merced County Jail, with correction staff.
Jesus, man. God. And then, so let's talk about, you're saying there's incidents of young men found hanging in their cells, you know, apparently committed,
yeah.
or it seems to be that they've committed suicide by hanging themselves
yeah.
with their underwear or something like that.
I'm not sure if sheets or not. The last one was a young woman, and I actually knew her from my teenage years. Her name was Aurora Felix, maiden name Powell, and she was found. And they said that she was in a housing unit alone. And I know that she has, you know, mental health issues. So my question was, how was she able to commit suicide, and why? You know what I mean? And before that, it was another gentleman. They could not release his name. But it's just really, it's scary. You know, there's so many suicides happening out, and it's specifically at the John Matarocca jail. And that's what, to me, is really suspicious. I do have to say suspicious, because I just don't see how they're happening every 6 to 8 weeks. You know, we don't go more than 90 days without somebody committing suicide, and that's weird to me.
Right. And it's interesting you brought up, you were saying that it seems to be that the sheriff's department are basically running drills in the jail as kind of, you said, a free training program. Can you explain a little more why you would think that could possibly be?
Well, we do have people that have worked closely or are currently working within the department that have, you know, mentioned that they felt that these type of drills were not standard, you know, due to the officers taking their badges off and wearing ski masks. And, you know, they go in without giving the inmates any time to get on the floor. So people are getting shot while they're trying to get down, and people are also continuing to be shot as they're on the ground. And, you know, one CO still had rounds in his gun. They call them bot guns. They shoot various types of projectiles. And a young 18-year-old kid was on the ground, and he was like, oh, his gun's not empty. He just went ahead and shot that kid in his back a few times and injured him. So we brought it to light at the board meeting because of what we got from, you know, the people that are cooperating with us from within that own department to let us know that they feel like this is some type of free training, because they're doing them every 8 to 12 months, and, you know, they have to do training once per year.
And these are live rounds that they're using, or these are, you said, some projectile weapons like beanbags or wooden dowels or
yeah.
something like that?
Yeah, there's rubber rounds, beanbags, and then pepper rounds. Like, those ones are burned as
right.
well when they shoot. And then the flash grenades. And then bringing in the dogs, you know, so it's really...
Wow.
It's pretty crazy. It's like something that you see in like a large prison raid or something, but it's happening at a jail. And our Merced County jail facility is not large. It's fairly small.
Now, I know in like other Central Valley places, other jails, like, there'll be, you know, kind of not common incidents, but, like, people will be there for, like, long time, like, you know, up to 3 years or something. They'll be in, like, a holding facility. Is that how it is in Merced, too, or is it mostly just people that are going to cycle out within, like, a month or so?
No. There are people that have been in there for significant amounts of time. My own spouse has been in there for almost 3 years, 8 months, finding an evading case, which is really strange because we have homicide cases from 2015 that had already went to trial this year and already been, you know, finished up and, you know, people have been sentenced. So, yeah, it, some people can just pretty much, I would call it, they just let them rot in there. Sometimes, they hold them for as long as they can, and then the cases get thrown out, dismissed, or whatever, and then they just let the people go. But if they hold them for a significant amount of time, they delay the court process, you know, and then ultimately, many times, detain in the jail.
Right, whereas most people, if they had money, would bail out, and then they would just, they wouldn't have to deal with that, and their case would probably be dropped. Or if you are able to bail out, it's a lot easier to fight the case. But you're saying in the case of somebody that does not do that, then they're just stuck rotting in jail for sometimes up to a couple years, which is just insane. I mean, we're talking about a county jail for essentially petty crimes.
Yes.
You know, if they are in fact quote guilty.
Yes, sir.
Wow, that's okay. So let's back up a couple months. You were talking about one of these raids. I guess my first question, has this been in the news, this type of stuff? And then you were talking about how you brought this up to the Board of Supervisors. So what's been the response from the powers that be? And has the media picked up on this story at all? Or has this kind of just not been reported on at all?
Then they did a report on the portion of what happened with the raid. No one reported. We have Merced County Times, Merced Sun Star. You know, I was questioned by the reporter from the Sun Star in regards to specifics, you know, what happened at the raid, like what injuries sustained and whatnot. And then there was nothing printed in the paper in regards to that. So the most exposure that we did receive was when we went to the Board of Supervisors on July 12th. So, yeah, it's kind of like our voices are being suppressed, so they're not trying to get the word out what's happening here.
So the Board of Supervisors is essentially silent on the issue. They see nothing wrong with what's going on in the jail, and they're not concerned that individuals keep showing up in, you know, dead in the facility, or the sheriffs continue to injure people in these raids.
No, they have not made an effort to reach out to me. I actually emailed them on September 9th in the afternoon to make sure they had an attachment of the inmate demand letter and why they were choosing to participate in this peaceful protest. And I have not heard back from any member of Board of Supervisor at all whatsoever. And we have 5 people sitting on that board at this time.
Gotcha. Okay, well, let's go up to September 9th, only a couple days ago. Can you talk about the demands that were issued by the prisoners and what happened on that day on September 9th? What exactly did the inmates do? And also, you all had a rally on the outside as well.
Yeah. So, a couple minutes before 10 a.m., well, a few minutes before 10 a.m., we had convened outside of the Merced County Jail, which is also the Sheriff's Department main facility. And the inmates gave their demand letter internally to the COs, and they immediately placed them on administrative lockdown. They're asking, you know, they decided to revoke their prison rights, and they wanted to protest, you know, in solidarity with worldwide prison and jail strikes, you know, on September 9th. And also, they wanted to hope to call on Governor Jerry Brown to sign the SB 1143, which will end juvenile solitary confinement, which many of them have been affected by in our jail as well. Some individuals are being housed in solitary confinement as pretrial detainees. You know, so they're basically put that all out there. They were immediately put on lockdown. We had our rally for almost 2 hours outside. We had multiple testimonies. Our son, which was one, he's 13 years old, giving testimony as to how it feels to have his father inside this facility and not know if his father's safe. We just had so much going on. We had blackberries, we had prayer, we had the Native American, you know, drum. It was just beautiful. It was heart-wrenching. It was so moving and powerful. We had a large turnout from our stand. We had over 30 people.
Yeah.
And from our set, that's pretty big.
Yeah.
Some people just walking by or going to put commissary money on their family's books came out and joined us, you know, because they were like, wow, somebody cares about what my loved one is going through and what my family is also experiencing. So it was wonderful, you know, to make some new connections and have those individuals also participate in getting their testimony. It was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really great you all did that. So they were put on lockdown, and then what happened? What was the further response from the prison, the jail administration, the sheriff's department? How did they respond after the inmates were put on lockdown?
Well, that afternoon I sent the email, and I CC'd all board supervisors, our sheriff, our Captain Sullivan, who is the head of sheriff correction, as well as our court. She runs our court, Linda Ramirez-Holf. So she's over the Merced Superior Court, you know, in regards to what was happening. I didn't receive any responses, but by 5:12, I started receiving phone calls, and other folks started receiving phone calls. So after I sent that email, they lifted the lockdown within 2.5 hours. So that was nice. But the following day, which was Saturday, they went into one block. So Lieutenant Moore alleged that he saw people on video making weapons. And they went in with dogs. They didn't wear ski masks this time, which was good. And no one was shot this time. But some officers were not wearing badges. And they took the inmates out by force. They searched and tossed the cells. And then they put them back in their housing unit and gave them back their phone privileges. And today is another incident of them putting them on lockdown. So they have been on lockdown on three separate occasions.
And do you feel that they're just making this up as an excuse, that there's people with weapons in the facility? I mean, do you think that's a ruse, or what is your impression as to these lockdowns, their ultimate goal?
I feel that they're trying to impede and, you know, stop the hunger strike. You know, they're trying to undermine it. They've been sending medical down to the inmates participating in this, offering them protein drinks and food, attempting to weigh them. They're refusing all movement. They're telling them now, all of a sudden now, that they can't refuse yard, they can't refuse court, and they can't refuse medical. So it's still their right if they want to refuse these things, because they're saying it's slowing up the system, but they weren't making any effort to have them go to yard on Monday. So when they said they had to go today, I was like, red flag, and Lieutenant Moore authorized it. It's just and then the seeing weapons being made on video, Lieutenant Moore also stated they saw them making weapons. So I hope that those videos are going to be reviewed at the time that he allegedly saw this taking place, because I don't feel that individual is being honest.
Right. So inmates in the facility are on hunger strike. Did that start on September 9th?
Yes. They stopped consuming food on the evening of the 8th to make sure that they were prepared for Friday. And they have been keeping strong. Some inmates have been calling with concerns because, you know, they're going through it now. We're a weekend, and they're feeling that the COs are, and the staff and the department are not taking their sacrifice seriously, and that they're not going to see change. And we want to see some type of effort being made.
And again, their demands are based around ending juvenile detention, but then also, what was the other core demands?
They do not want the protective custody inmates handling their food.
Right.
Clothing or chemicals, that was the main one. And then Lieutenant Moore, based on, you know, interactions with him, being very derogatory, disrespectful, abusive, he subjects inmates to multiple body scans. At any given time, he'll just pick and choose. So he's putting them at risk with radiation exposure just because he feels like it. He threatens inmates. He threatens to put inmates in, like, different housing segments and telling them that they're, you know, they're debriefing, so basically putting them at risk for being injured or killed, he threatened their life. And it's a really scary individual. I don't know how he's still able to have any type of oversight over the inmates that are participating in the hunger strike that are asking for him to be removed from the detail. So that's like the most significant one. And then the housing. And then there was an inmate that they wanted, they're requesting, his name is Ricardo Herrera, date of birth, 12/22/1982. And he was removed after the raid on June 30th. And he also made claims against the county of Merced, and they were heard at the board meeting on July 12th. And he has been stuck in a one-man cell, and that's considered solitary confinement. And he's been agreeing to attempt to get out and placed back into his normal housing. But they are punishing him, or I believe they're punishing him for making claims against the county of Merced.
That was an excerpt of an interview with Victoria, a member of Live Free Merced. Victoria is on hunger strike in solidarity with the approximately 100 prisoners who are also on hunger strike in two Merced County jails in Central Valley, California. The entire interview can be heard on itsgoingdown.org. To support the 100 prisoners on hunger strike in Merced County jails, you can call the jails to demand the repression end and that the prisoners' demands are met. The phone number to call is 209-385-7419. It is 11:58, and this is the Prison Radio Show, and we are not going to have time to read you the entire text of a letter that was written from prisoners in Canada to striking prisoners in the U.S. I'm going to excerpt a little tiny bit of it here, but if you want to read the entirety of the letter, we will post it on our blog. And once I read this excerpt, I will also read you a P.O. box where if you're inside and you want to write and get a full copy of this letter of support, you can write to the people who wrote the letter and they will probably write you back. So here's a tiny bit of it. It says, first, we want to tell you that you are not alone. We are keeping our eyes on your struggles. We support you. In your call for a strike on September 9th, you evoke the uprising in Attica that began on September 9th, 1971. You write about ending prison slavery by ceasing to be slaves yourselves. We see you, we hear you, we support you. And the letter goes on to talk about Prisoner Justice Day, which is a traditional work stoppage inside federal prisons, mostly in Canada, but also internationally, that happens on August 10th. And the letter also talks a bit about a list of demands that were released from some prisoners in federal prison in Canada. It was a letter to Justin Trudeau demanding a bunch of different things, including access to provincial minimum wages, access to the Canadian pension plan, and real workplace insurance. These prisoners were writing about their struggle in order to like share the kinds of things that they're going through. So if you want to read the entire text of that letter, you can check out our blog, which is prisonradioshow.wordpress.com.